Hello and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, fresh from the traffic chaos downtown, but I survived. You know, it's Guelph, we endure.
I hear there's free ice cream.
Oh, yes, somewhere. That's for a future date.
Our guest is smirking. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcasts on the Podbean and iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play channels as well. Today, we consider some of the recent development matters before City Council, like 75 Dublin Street North, and that decision was last night, and Claire Maltby was last week. And what's everyone mad about now? We'll discuss that. And then we will talk about the money, the value of money and keeping people sick. Goldman Sachs certainly likes the profit motive in not curing diseases, but should we really be surprised? So we're going to talk about greedy people at the back half of the show. But for the first half...
Non-greedy people.
Greed is not good.
Sorry to jump in
greed
there.
Greed is not good, but we are grateful that Mayor Cam Guthrie has donated some of his very precious time to us today to talk about stuff going on at City Hall. Mayor Guthrie, thank you for coming back on Open Sources and talking
thanks
to
for,
us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I do want to ask one question in regards to the 75 Dublin last night. I think a lot of people were watching that one. And correct me if I'm wrong, but when this came before council in December 2016, I think it was you who proposed an amendment to approve the five-story development that Riker Holdings wanted, even though the staff recommended the four-story. But you didn't do that last night. I was curious as to why.
So I can't recall if I was the one that moved that motion in 2016, only because as the chair I wouldn't be allowed to. So I'm wondering if someone else did.
Maybe.
But I probably supported that last night. The issue as I saw it last night, before the vote was called, was strictly how through my lens, was the extra story would allow an opportunity for 20 affordable units for seniors, and without it, it wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And that's how I viewed it. And there's obviously people in the community that viewed it different. Staff viewed it different, and other counselors viewed it differently, and that's fine. That's absolutely fine with me. I felt that the fifth story, weighted out compared to what the result or the benefit would be with the affordable units. That to me it made sense.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I probably wouldn't have agreed to six or seven or eight, stories, but the fifth seemed reasonable in the realm of reasonable to me personally. But council speaks as one voice now. You know, that as you just said, it was last night, so we're moving forward now. The council has made the decision. We speak as one voice, and so we're going with the staff recommendation as we move forward.
Fair enough. I did also want to ask about things that are kind of specifically in the news right now. I know a lot of you probably heard a lot about the winter storm last weekend and the cleanup.
There was a storm last weekend?
Yeah. It was yes, it wasn't a big thing. But I know a lot of people have been talking about the sidewalks and some streets not getting the immediate care. I wonder what insight you could glean in terms of where city crews are with that and when people might see the recovery.
Well, I do know that the crews have been out constantly since the storm. Actually, just even before the storm started, they started actually treating the roads and the sidewalks before that. And they've been out constantly. The problem was it the second or third day? I'm sorry, I can't remember. When the storm sort of stopped, got warmer, they're out, and then there was that quick turnaround in the weather become – it was freezing all of a sudden. And it just – it completely blocked the – especially the sidewalks. Mm-hmm. And so the our machinery just – it got stuck. It couldn't go or it was just not doing anything.
Right.
And so just today, actually, at about 12:30, I happened to be driving to the ICC Center, the Italian Canadian Club, and I happened to see one of the sidewalk plows working its way down York Road. And so I actually pulled over and did a quick video, which I'm going to post later, that says, see, they are out. but you know what? City staff have been great in taking requests from people for problem areas that have been coming up that haven't been there yet. They're probably already on the list, but it's good to hear from the citizens anyways of where exactly they are. But it's important, too, for the citizens to remember that it's priority areas that have to be dealt with first, schools, hospitals, high traffic areas, and things like that. So, you know, those are the areas that people that our staff are attending to. And it's going to get done. But it as I sometimes say, weather happens. This morning, I don't know if you saw on my Twitter, I actually grabbed a screenshot of two other mayors, basically saying the struggle is real. The mayor of Barrie apologizing all up and down about how the crews are doing their best to battle the snow and removing the snow. And then I grabbed a screenshot from Linda Jeffery, the mayor of Brampton, almost the exact same wording. us mayors are we're all saying the same thing to all of our citizens. And it's nice to see at least we're all replying.
Yes. I was going to bring this up later, but since we're talking about posting stuff online, you know, you're very active on social media.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's a lot of discussion right now about, you know, the positives and the negatives of, you know, being plugged in and all that. But, you know, in terms of your own experience, how would you place the value of interacting with people on social media, and does that make your job easier or harder?
Well, that's a really great question. You know, I think I was out in Vancouver a couple of months ago, and I happened to be sitting beside and having dinner with the mayor Helps, Lisa Helps, which is the mayor of Vancouver City. And she was just a big article about her in the Globe and Mail, I think a couple of weeks ago, actually saying that she's gotten off Facebook, she's off social media now because she just felt like the dialogue and the discussion just had no positive benefit to anything at all. And I feel the opposite. I really like engaging with people. I like asking people their opinions and what is important to them, what, you know, we could do better. I really like that. The flip side to that, and I have actually said this once, I think it was last year, I sort of made a post where I needed people to understand that in total, there's 27,000 people that follow me on social media. And I don't say that as a brag thing at all.
Yeah.
It's just, imagine 27,000 people
right.
Asking you questions, demanding you questions in some ways, demanding answers in some ways, or looking for advice, like literally constantly coming to you. And that's not including then emails.
Right.
And that's not including the phone calls. That's not including the meetings I'm having all day. That's not – I'm not a victim here at all. But I needed people to understand, to put it in context, that if it takes me a day to get back to you, please understand that it's not on purpose.
Yeah.
You might be the 400th person that's in line, right? So, but I really enjoy engaging with people. And I would really say, honestly, 95% or higher really, really also, I think, appreciate the engagement that I do online.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. Let's get to some wonkish stuff, because one thing that I was curious about, and I think a lot of people had their eyes on, was happening this month was the completion of the solid waste service review that was supposed to happen last week, but it got canceled, and I'm wondering why. What's the delay?
So what I've been told from staff is that they basically have more work to do. That they're not fully there with some final recommendations, and they're not only awaiting some information internally but externally as well. And that's fine. You know, I think I said if I recall, at the meeting in like October maybe last year when we were first presented with sort of where the five departments out of the six of the waste service review, you know, were highlighted doing really, really well. But then there was a sixth area. And it was stated that we would have a final recommendation in November. In November, council, you know, felt along with staff that we really wouldn't be fully informed yet to make a decision. And it was best, and I totally agreed, that we need to make decisions when we're best informed or fully informed. And so if we needed to wait, then we'll wait. And so this is part of that waiting that is taking place. But that doesn't mean that we're waiting for fun. It's not like a report is done and it's just sitting around and we're not dealing with it.
Right.
They're collecting more information so that we can be more fully informed so we can make a proper decision.
I think people might hear that, though, and wonder, like, is the sixth area, which I believe is the material resource facility, is it that bad there that all this extra consideration has to be done?
Well, from what I know already, and it's already public, is, I mean, you know, it's a $2.5 million problem that was rooted out because of the service review and highlighted it. And that takes time to be able to address it. There's not only processes in place, but people that have to be that are involved with this issue as well. And so if taking time to make sure that we're treating everyone correctly and getting, as I said, all the right information is required, then that's the way I want to make decisions. And so I'll make sure that we're doing it in that format.
Okay. Well, fair enough. The other big thing, I mean, there's a service review happening in that too, but I mean, you did go to the trouble last month of having a town hall. I think it was very well received on transit. What's the follow up there in terms of what you took away from that and what you're working on now in terms of transit concerns?
Yeah, so thanks for highlighting that. You know, councilors Alt and Hoffman and others actually all showed in the audience wise showed up for that as well. So it was, and I did Facebook Live it too, so you know everyone could kind of see it. So what I did, I think the following day is I made a blog post to inform everyone that hey, you came, we listened, but what's next? It's you know, it's really great to say that you listened or you had a town hall, but what are you actually doing? And I think people know that I'm that type of person. It's like, okay, now action. What are we doing now? So I put all of the feedback that was collected that night, I put it all into a chart form, and I actually sent it through to staff so that they could look at every single issue that was brought up. And now what I'm waiting to hear back, and I did have a meeting actually this week, just to give you a follow-up, so I'm glad you asked. I had a meeting this week with staff about that chart and how they are going to be addressing that, either, you know, yes, this item or this issue can be addressed, or no, and then the reasons why, as we move through those numerous issues that popped up at that town hall meeting. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was actually really good. You know, those are those types of things where it gets myself and others out of the bubble a little bit, you know, from being in City Hall and going to the boots on the ground, to the users, to the end users of our services, and says, you know, in an open manner, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? And, you know, those types of questions should be asked more often in government.
What's going to happen to the chart?
I'm going to put it back online.
Okay.
So the chart is going to be, when it's filled out by staff, I'm going to transparently put it all online.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool. Did I black out in the middle of a conversation with the mayor? Did he say that before I...
It's on the record now.
It's on the record now. It's on the record now.
Yeah.
It's in the archives forever and
ever. Keep it in.
Yeah.
Sure.
I have a duty to do that, though.
Yeah.
You guys understand
that.
I think you're right.
Sure.
Your listeners would understand that. And that's the whole part of following through. Like, just because I set up a town hall and people come and I say, oh, thanks a lot, and I shake some hands... People want to know, okay, but what's actually happening?
Yeah.
That chart, the reason why I put it into a chart is just to show that that it's the easiest format for me to send it to staff so that they could respond in their own column, and then I can put it back online and people can see it.
I just think from time to time, we get jazzed up about dealing with an issue, whatever the issue is, and there's a big conversation about it, and you get feedback. and it goes to staff, and then we kind of move on. And I think a lot of people just want to make sure that we don't move on, and that not that there's people are assuming you or staff aren't working on the problem, but.
And that's why I was saying, okay, what can we address now? What can't we? And if we can't, then tell me why. Is it money? Is it time? Is it resource? I think it's important for people to understand that we have professional staff that may have the answers that I don't.
Right.
I have to defer to them, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to follow up.
Right. Making this harder, though, is we don't have a permanent transit GM yet. Like administratively, I mean, I do realize there's an interim.
Yeah.
But, you know, does that make it more difficult to enact changes permanently or to work around this?
You know what? That's another excellent question. And I would wholeheartedly answer no.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, it's not about the title of the position, it's about who is there.
Mm.
And I am absolutely thrilled with the job that Robin is doing. I've had a meeting with him this week, and the feedback I'm receiving from not only inside City Hall, but from councilors and staff, but also from riders has been very, very good. So, yeah, sometimes it's easy to say we have an interim this, but you don't know. And it can, you know, rightly so, maybe conjure up some sort of optics around, oh, I don't know if that's a good person or not. I think what people need to hear is someone steady at the helm and doing a good job, no matter what their title is?
Yeah.
And this person is doing, Robin's doing an excellent job. And the main feedback or main theme I hear from him, which I would concur, is he's very customer service focused.
Okay.
And that really thrills me because that's what I want to have for all of our services that we provide. People is really excellent customer service.
And you know what? I will compliment Transit. I thought they handled what happened last weekend with the weather very well. I think that the updates on Twitter and downtown on there were, you know, written signs on some of the stops if, you know, they were only running on in like every hour or something.
Okay. Actually, I didn't know that. Yeah. So that, I appreciate that feedback. And
yeah. So yeah, I thought that worked rather well. So,
and that's the type of proactive customer service too. I think there's two realms of customer service, right? Mm-hmm. There's the reactive and the proactive. And I feel with Robin and with many of our other staff that they are, no matter what department, they are really this culture of being proactive with customer service and not just, you know, receiving complaints, trying to fix things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different way, a different culture of looking at customer service, and he's doing a very good job. And that culture at Transit is, I think, under really steady leadership with him right now.
Okay. Let's talk about other problems.
Oh, I thought that was it.
Well, you know, I do want to get...
Sounds like my wife at home. Now let's talk about other problems. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, honey, if you're listening.
Chart.
Yeah. Oh, I guarantee she has some charts and maybe Cam can confirm.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think things are heating up. And we talked about this, you know, when we bump into each other at things. But in particular, the Gordon Street intensification, you know, south of the way. I think one of the things I've been detecting at the planning meetings, and you've probably been detecting it too, and the other councilors, is that people are getting more and more heated about this. There's, you know, the number of delegations people are coming up whenever there's one of these new apartment projects coming forward, you know, to build along Gordon or in that area.
Yes.
People are kind of more and more concerned about this. And, I realize, you know, we're probably stuck between a rock and a hard place on this, but, you know, is there a way to balance concerns with, you know, the fact that we have to build and the demand is to build and there's kind of no two ways about it.
It's a difficult position. I'm sure I can speak on behalf of council for all 13 of us to be sitting there and to hear these concerns from our citizens, and to balance those concerns with, you know, the realities of we are the fastest growing city, and by the way, we're mandated to grow through legislation, through the places to grow and the growth plans. So you know, we've identified in our past official plans intensification corridors, as you just stated. Gordon is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense. If you think about being a planner, even if you think about, you know, that old computer game SimCity, when you're building a city, like you think about it, that's along big intensification arterial roads. You know, that's where intensification happens. Then off of those roads, you go into the residential areas where the intensification is less and less. I mean, that's just, you know, the standard type of planning. And it's trying to balance, as I said, that feedback from people that either one didn't know that it was an intensification corridor. Mm-hmm. And now they're finding out that, you know, along there, a 6-story building is about to be built.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want, you know, the shadow or the traffic or what they would define as a wall being built behind them. And then also trying to meet those legislative targets that Guelph is forced to do. I often say this a little bit jokingly, but it's not. If people have a really big problem with the intensification, they need to actually go to our MPP, to the province. Because council as one voice actually spoke through staff comments saying that we don't think that we should grow that much.
Mm.
But the legislation came down saying you should. Mm. So, you know, we have to meet those legislation targets. And I will continue to listen to both. But at the end of the day, it's going to be difficult, I think, for council to start to say, to continually say no to these types of developments, because it is, it's along intensification corridors, it's along transit corridors, it's along where commercial is available for people to walk to, and that is the future of medium to large size cities.
Mm.
So, kind of directly related to that, what's your view on the
local planning appeal tribunal as opposed to the death of the OMB, I guess, is coming. How do you see that affecting what's going to happen in future? Do you see like a sort of radically different challenges to, you know, when somebody gets a development rejected, say, or do you see that as improving the process? Or I guess that's yet to be tested, but
there were issues with the OMB that I agreed with why I think it needed reform. And I've been saying that for a while now. And so for it to be finally reformed, restated and defined, as you just said it, is, I think, a good thing. But we've yet to go through it.
Hasn't been tested yet.
And that's where I believe we're really going to start to, understand it better. Not only the impacts internally to City Hall, to our decisions and how we do our planning, but also the impacts to the community. And it's interesting, and I've seen and heard a little bit about this, where there could actually be moments where the new tribunal actually kicks the decision back to City Council, where they have to rethink it again, and then it might go back again. So,
but if it comes back, if I understand it right, you could say an outright no or a yes,
mm-hmm.
and then it doesn't get dumped back again? Or is it going to be like a continuous cycle? I got the impression that it was like, okay, it goes to the tribunal, it can come back, and if the city once again says no, not unlike 75 Dublin, then that's it. Or I guess you could always reapply or rejig your application. Or...
So you know what? I'm drawing a blank on purpose because okay. I can't I've read through it all, but I can't remember whether the reappeal or another decision can come from either the applicant or the there are some rights afforded to the applicant and some afforded to the council, and I can't remember which one it is that where it could trigger.
Try to put
that.
It on the spot.
Yeah, so because it's so new,
exactly,
and another councillor yesterday suggested that it would be nice to have not only for council but maybe for the public to get some sort of a training on this new thing, which I completely agree with. And so look forward to that too. That will be
especially since we're in this like weird area, because I was tweeting about the meeting last night about how the 75
that's right
is still in front of the OMB, and it's like, well, didn't the OMB, isn't that over? And it's like, well, no, because stuff that started under the OMB still has to complete that process.
That's right. Yeah,
it's a weird
in fact, I was thinking about that last night, where that particular decision for 75 Dublin Street, for those in the know, I wonder if it will be almost a test case, because you think about it. Mm-hmm. This is, you got one where it's sitting over here and one where it's sitting over another set of rules.
Interesting.
And, I think it'll be very interesting to see this go all the way out to whatever the decision is at the end. I bet you a lot of people, a lot of cities, a lot of councils a lot of planners, a lot of developers will all be looking at how did this work
right.
before it concluded,
right.
whatever that conclusion is.
I think that might be interesting to everyone in this room and maybe a couple others. But
yeah.
We are running out of time, unfortunately, but there's a provincial election coming up, and I know there's a municipal election coming up, but I don't want to touch on that. But, you know, the provincial one's coming up, and I'm wondering for you, as the representative of the city of Guelph, are there particular issues for you that you would like to see debated? Not necessarily what, you know, what parties are offering, but like just the issues themselves and what you want to see, you know, come up in terms of municipal issues that is in the provincial portfolio.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked that. I have no problem answering it either. Because that's right. My role is to be an advocate for the city of Guelph. And I would say this to every single, you know, party candidate that walks in my office or asks me that exact question. So maybe they don't need to ask, they can just listen to this now. The biggest one will definitely be, I'm going to hit some themes.
Sure.
General infrastructure will be one. You know, the immense pressure of the backload of infrastructure for every city is unbelievable. And you have now cities across Ontario having to have fees, levies, all these things to try to you know, fix that issue. Where can the province actually come in and try to alleviate some of those pressures that are loaded on the backs, the full burden on property taxpayers? So infrastructure is one. High-speed rail is number two. I am very, very interested to hear what every party says about that, because that is needed for Guelph and needed for our region. And it's moving forward, so I want to know where everyone stands on that one, because we fought for that and got it, and I am holding on to that one. Okay, so that's another one. And then the other one is going to be around mental health, and mental health, you know, spikes out or into other issues, which would be, you know, it can come into housing and it can come into other addictions, and that is still an area that I believe is not fully resourced up yet. It's not, and it needs to be identified a lot more. It's easy for municipal politicians to say, well, it's a provincial issue because it's healthcare,
right.
But it's affecting the municipal bottom line, and not just financially, socially, culturally, for every city. And I think that needs to be really addressed as well. So I think, you know, I could go on for other stuff. I mean, it's easy to pick, you know, education, healthcare, transportation, all this kind of stuff. But I think from a Guelph perspective, infrastructure, high-speed rail, mental health issues, housing, you know, opioid crisis, things like that. Those are some things that I want to listen, sit back a bit, and hear from the candidates locally and those that are running for premier, to see what their plans are for that.
High-speed rail, that's an added infrastructure, because we have to make a lot of roads underpasses.
Correct.
Yeah, I'm just the things all tie to each other.
Well, yes, yes. I don't know if they all need to be, but yeah. It's going to be a huge infrastructure.
Right.
Yeah. Of course, I mean, the province and the federal government just made that announcement about a month ago, the $106 million for transit. But it doesn't have to be for buses. It can be transit in general. And so I think – and that's over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so I think that will – you know, when you bring up high-speed rail, that begs the question, what type of infrastructure do we have to do in Guelph to accept – not only two-way go, all-day go, but also high-speed rail. What kind of infrastructure is required there? So maybe out of that $106 million, do we have to earmark some of that for that? So it's not just transit. It could be active transportation as well, and then transit as well. So we're going to have to wait to hear back from staff on where they feel that would be best allocated.
Hyperloop. Hyperloop all the way.
Yeah, monorail.
What about a Stargate?
Monorail. Stargate. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure the monorail went wrong.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll have to call it there and to be continued. So Mayor Guthrie, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Yeah, thank you to you both. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ken.
Yeah, we will see you around, and I guess we'll wrap that up there.
Okay, have that a good day.
Kind of lost my train of thought there, but that's okay, because we have a commercial break and a musical break right now, and we will take that break and come back with some news from the past week. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
That's some swinging cats. Falls on a host of jazz show. No, not really. That's the Jen Hodge All-Stars from her new album, All's Fair in Love and Jazz, new to the station. And that song was Swing It, Sister. Indeed. So check her out, Jen Hodge and her All-Stars.
They're great.
We never play jazz, really, do we? That's a bit of change.
No.
Oh, she's the bass player. JenHodgeBass.com for more information.
Guelph isn't really known for jazz, though. It's kind of...
We have a jazz festival, do we not?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe Jen Hodge, yeah. I know what you mean, though. It's like, you know, Charles Mingus was not from Guelph.
I was trying to make a joke.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It was that because
we're taking everything so seriously because we had the mayor and everything's so serious.
Jeez, this is a serious show now. Really, now we got to talk about serious things.
Like development.
Yeah, we got development. So as we were talking about with the mayor last night, there was the special city council meeting about the Riker Holdings proposal to build at 75 Dublin Street, which if you're not sort of like, you know, sort of a eidetic memory about Guelph geography, it's the tennis courts across the road from the Basilica of Our Lady. Riker Holdings wanted to build a five-story development. I think it's 34 total units, 20 for affordable housing. Staff recommended only 4 stories, and council voted, I want to say, 7-5 in favor of the staff proposal.
I think that's what I read this morning, yes.
I was there.
Yeah, he said, I think. It's like, yeah. You guys are all tired. Cam's, you're tired. That's your giving it.
Well, I mean, it wasn't that late. I was actually surprised that we got out of there before 9:30.
Oh, wow, that is early.
No, maybe it was at some. No, of it those, was quarter to, more like quarter to 10.
Okay. Some of those hot button meetings are epic, right?
I mean, it was a hot button midnight meeting for sure, but yeah. It wasn't. I'm not sure. It was
full house, pretty much. I always go by
it was
how many
full
people. Yeah,
I mean, there were 27 delegates.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, it's the fascinating thing about this is maybe it's not that fascinating, but. The
case, Bach. Fascinating.
But this has come up before. This was the second bite of the apple. And as we were talking about on the show, this is something that's still before the OMB, the first 75 Dublin decision. So it's entirely possible it could happen anyway. And all this was kind of for naught. I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds like the... as I mentioned to Cam there about the OMB versus the new Local Planning Appeal Tribunal, if you're locked into the OMB chain, let's say, then that's where it's the appeal is going to go through. And mm-hmm. then anything beyond that certain date, which is soon, is going to be under the new tribunal. So that'll be interesting as well. How many things will get, I don't know, I wouldn't say rammed through, but the appeals process. I don't know if that's why there's this drive to do this. You were at the meetings. I was sort of followed you a bit on Twitter. This is one of those things where it's like, I get the impression that the words, in particular 75 Dublin, affordable housing, are being misused.
Yeah.
I think I have a really different concept of what affordable housing is. And I kind of don't like the fact that is the, I wouldn't say holding the whole thing hostage in terms of whether it's getting developed or not, but it seems like a weird kind of rider to have in there to say, if we don't get this, we're going to do this. The other part of it too, which I think is kind of weird and I'm surprised it's being asked for, is a land swap. I mean, this is pretty ballsy stuff, right?
Right.
I'm kind of hoping that this new process, I don't think it's going to be the panacea, but I hope it'll clear this kind of stuff up. It's like, I think somebody's got a lot of nerve to ask, well, you know, instead of this, I'll just do this and give me a land swap and everything will be okay. Like, they're really asking for a lot. It's either like, you develop it, city council approves it or doesn't approve it or says go back to the table, or they don't. There seems to be all this kind of like horse trading going on. I think I personally think, you know, as a taxpayer, and I rarely use that line, that it's ridiculous. Like, it's just, I think developers have to realize that they can't just get everything that they want. It's always ask for the moon and you really wanted like a couple asteroids. I don't know. Like what?
Yeah. Interesting analogy.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. Sorry.
I'll talk about the affordable housing piece in a sec, but the land swap thing, I don't think you're entirely wrong. And this kind of came out of, I don't want to say nowhere, because I think people were kind of floating the idea before Tom Lammer, who's the owner of Riker, sent an email almost right before the last council meeting on this. Sent an email to staff and said, hey, yeah, sure, let's talk about a land swap, except, you know, there's not really any land downtown that I want.
And he also asked that it couldn't be a brownfield, right? He wanted, like, clean, ready to go somehow.
Yes, that's, I mean...
And I believe...
Again, that falls under the land he doesn't want, because a couple of people were pushing, I think it's 55 McDonnell Street.
Where the Mercury building was? Is that what was hinted at?
No, it's the parking lot between where the Vote for Nobody mural used to be.
Oh, yes, of course.
Because
we don't need the parking.
Well, that was something people were bringing up, is like, are we going to really put another downtown parking lot on the block while we're dealing with Wilson, while we've got the West Parkade down? And besides the point, 55 McDonald, like actually a lot of parking lots downtown, like on Fountain Street, God only knows what's buried under all that concrete in terms of stuff that needs remediating.
Suppose it's the worst site in town, if
Rumor
not in Guelph.
It.
It was the Union Gas yard, right?
Yeah.
Where the police are parking now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's supposedly one of the worst. But yeah, there's some exploration going on there, though, right?
They were doing some exploring, I want to say either last summer or last fall.
And they pulled the cores up and said, oh my God.
Yeah. And a couple of guys walked in and a couple of Mutant Ninja Turtles walked out.
If it's Baker Street, it's skulls. And if it's Fountain Street, it's toxins, probably, right?
Yeah. And I think on one of the articles I wrote about on Politico, there's actually a picture of like, gas building terminology, but
the gas yard, like
the gas yard. You can see what it used to look like, and you would probably never want to park there again, or walk across that parking lot, or eat at one of those fast food restaurants that are behind it.
That's pretty much all you can make it into is a parking lot, unless we're at the point where the land value is getting so expensive that, they're exploring things that they said, oh, we'll never build on that. A good example is Chemtura and the ward as well. We'll never, right. We think we talked about this. We'll never, ever build anything on that. It's so toxic. And now it's like, well, you know what? It's probably not that toxic. And then, of course, there's the clean and green development in the South End.
Yeah.
Claire Maltby, which is now back on the radar. And what did you find at City Council with that? Is it as heated as 75 Dublin? Or are people like, yeah, it's going to be developed? Or...
Well, I mean, that's a bit more complex because that's a big, huge area that is mostly undeveloped. And really the only people who have shown, have spoke out against, I mean, it was almost the entire Rolling Hills neighborhood. I mean, if I was a cat burglar, that probably would have been a good night to go down there and rob some houses.
Doo-doo. Yeah.
But, because a lot of people were there.
Please do not take our advice on that.
But I mean, no, we're not endorsing burglary. Unless it's at the Watergate. No, I'm kidding. Anyway. this is a big, huge area of open land. It is the last big area of open land in the city that... of green space. So it has to be done. It has to be done right. I think the number is like 17,000 people to go in there. So it's not, chump change at all.
No.
And this has been pointed out too, that, Guelph is one of the furthest, along the 401 corridor, it's the furthest community from the 401. So Claire Maltby would certainly... help with that. If you're looking to maybe build in Guelph and maybe start a business, but you want a bit more easier access to the 401, building somewhere between Claire and Maltby would certainly help with the commute. It's going to be tricky because there's a lot of influence there, a lot of money, despite the fact that the people in the Rolling Hills neighborhood were tagging themselves with phrases like working class and middle class.
That's like affordable housing in quotes.
Yeah, it's Oh, yeah, I didn't get to affordable. I'll get to affordable housing after this bit. But
yeah, but no, that's an insult to me as somebody from the working class.
There's a couple
not possible.
There's a couple of aspects to it. First of all, in the Rolling Hills area, almost all of that land surrounding it is marked off. If you look at the preferred layout, it's almost marked off as all of it as reserve, and then most of it, mostly along Clare, is low density. So that neighborhood isn't going to change, I don't think, too radically much. I think the trickier part is the environmental angle, which is where that land meets the Paris Gulf Moraine.
The barn swallows and the snapping turtles and the things that developers don't give a cack about. Right?
Well, I mean, the developers might not, but environmentalists in the city certainly do. If you look at the map, there's a road that runs north-south east of Gordon on the proposed development, and it goes through the wetland a couple of times, like the thinnest pieces of the wetland. And
it was built before these things were thought about, right?
Right. It hasn't been built yet, but this is proposed.
Oh, this is a proposed road. Yeah.
And it kind of like matrix its way through, even though it's supposed to be a main road, because it's trying to go through the thinnest points of the wetland, because you can't actually build something straight through from Clare to Maltby without passing through some kind of wetland.
It'll also be good traffic control if it isn't dead straight, right?
So it's, that part of it is going to be slippy for sure. And that I think that's the aspect to keep, for people who are environmentally concerned, that's the aspect to keep your eyes out for. Going back to affordable versus, I agree with you. I think that we hear affordable and we think social housing. And I think even like seasoned people like me and people on council who deal with this stuff all the time, it's easy to get the two confused. I don't think there's anything malicious in it, because when you think affordable, you think, okay, anyone can dip into this. But what it really means is affordable as compared to market rate. And, there's been a bit of a real estate bubble out there.
Yeah.
Things are massively inflated.
But in the case of 75 Dublin, it was supposed to be for seniors, right?
It's geared to seniors, yeah.
So the seniors who sell up their house and get a ton of money for it and then buy a flat or
empty
an apartment.
Who can downsize,
and then live off the remains of that, I guess, until they need further attention or whatever. So I just think they need a different name for it than affordable housing. Even just call it seniors housing, but I know that that's in a different category.
I mean, there's a need for both. There's a need, there are a lot of people out there who could probably buy a home who are priced out of the market because someone from Toronto can swoop in pay like $200,000 or $300,000 over asking. But there's, that doesn't ignore the fact that there's an incredible need for social housing as well for people who just can't afford to get anywhere close to the market at all. And that's where the confusion is, because as you said, people here are affordable and they think.
And also, could you imagine the blowback if the entire thing was going to be a social housing development? It'd probably be worse.
Well, I mean,
than living in the shadows.
Right.
Which reduces skin cancer or something, right?
I think that was one of
the
selling points.
I know, this is like the ridiculous comment. It's like,
even though there were a couple of kids at the meeting who got up and delegated, and they were like, I've seen...
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they were like, we've seen fights in the schoolyard for who gets to play in the sun.
it's like The Simpsons again, right?
It was a little bit Simpsons. We should go to that school sometime.
Where is the sun?
Yeah, to see kids fight over who gets to play in the sun. Like it's
my turn to play in the sun.
Like it's John Carpenter's Vampires or something. Anyway, but the what you were saying about affordable housing in there, I've talked to a number of people about this, and there are a lot of cynical people out here who think that Riker, and despite they do have a good reputation in the city.
Commander Riker.
Nah, we're not going to go there.
No, I did. Sorry.
They're talking about limits of 20 years that in the last proposal, it was about, having these affordable units for 20 years, and in 20 years, they can be turned over and sold at market value. And a lot of people are seeing this as kind of sort of deeply cynical, trying to get government money to build.
Oh, absolutely.
To take some of the sting off building this thing. And then, in 20 years, making a killing on the back end by selling affordable units for full market price. That's one person or several people's conspiracy theory, and we'll have to move on to another conspiracy theory, because when I heard this story, I immediately thought, like, how many years have people been saying drug companies are keeping cures to diseases so they can keep making money? And here we have Goldman Sachs in a memo basically saying, gene therapy is going to be great for people suffering from disease, but it's going to kill our bottom line.
This reminded me of that study years ago. You may recall where it came out and it said, well, smokers are good because they die early and they save on pension funds. You don't have to pay out. So since they're gone early, you don't need to worry. This is like that sort of, and I suppose there is some truth to that, but there's no like 100-year-old smokers. This is raw capitalist stuff. This is like, you know, human health and human beings as commodity.
Yeah.
You know, Martin Shkreli approach to like, Shkreli? Shkreli?
Shkreli.
Shkreli.
Shkreli. Farmer bro. Just say farmer bro.
You know that farmer bro dirtbag that's in jail? That turd of a human being that's, in my view.
Sorry. Oh, they put him in real jail. They didn't put him in club.
He's
fed.
Not in Camp Cupcake?
He wanted Camp Cupcake, but they put him in real jail.
Oh, good. Good. Not that
white-collar jail, Asa.
Not that Conrad Black jail where it's like, yes, I'm teaching the inmates English. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Well, it does matter to some degree. I mean, you know, this is how far we've come, like from the days of, Banting and Best, let's say, diabetes treatment. Let's make it available to the people for a buck. Now, mind you, that's changed a bit. And I was thinking about Jonas Salk as well.
Sure.
Who came up with a polio vaccine. You know, I think his exact comment was, the people own this patent, right? Yeah. So you had scientists toiling away in the name of science and public health. And then now it becomes, you've commodified disease. Now, gene therapy is a complicated matter. But I mean, it sounds like it's a matter of, well, we're not going to make, let's say, $12 billion. We're only going to make $5 billion. So in that land of diminishing returns, is curing patents or curing patients a sustainable business model, patenting the cures?
Well, that's a specific example you mentioned from Gilead, who's a company that made a hepatitis C treatment that cures hepatitis C 90% of the time. And corporate profit in 2015 was $12.5 billion, and then their corporate profit for this year is projected to be about $4 billion. But that's because you cure
only
people of Hep
billion?
C.
Yeah.
You know,
and you're not spreading it once it's gone as well, right?
So
I do know somebody that got that treatment, and it's really expensive. I think it was covered to some degree, but it was something like $100,000.
Yeah.
So if it's the same treatment or something similar, but I mean, that's massive, right? Like,
but yeah, and that's why they're still making $4 billion a year.
Oh, sure. Yeah, because that's the Canadian price. I'm sure, elsewhere, I'm sure it's more.
But I was reading somebody commenting about this, but they're pointing that out that, big pharma is a $1 trillion a year industry. It's multiple trillions of dollars, but they're always the first to cry poverty. Oh. And I appreciate that the first pill costs, maybe several million, maybe several billion dollars, and then each subsequent bill is like 10 cents or 12 cents or whatever.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as you said, this is a business that's sort of geared towards helping people. And, when does the profit motive become too greedy? First of all, what they're talking about with gene therapy, this is probably still a number of years away. But there was also another example of, GlaxoSmithKline sold their gene therapy, labs to a small English company in exchange for 20% share. But because they don't want to pursue this research, one of the things that they were working on actually was a form of therapy to treat the immunity disorder that that basically created Bubble Boy and people who have to live I can't remember what the actual disease's name is.
I'm sure we'll remember it at 6:01 tonight. What it is.
Well, that's usually how these things go.
Yeah.
But that the gene therapy that they're working on may allow people to not have to live in bubbles anymore who suffer from, but it's a rare disorder too. So it's something that, even when they have the breakthrough and they can offer people this treatment, they're still not going to make a lot of money on. And it's this just very icky thing where they're focused purely on, like, we need to keep people sick in order to make money, which is a very limited way of looking at how to make money. Because on the other end, and this the piece I mentioned earlier mentioned this too, is there no economic value to people not taking up hospital beds anymore and being, able to work and being able to be more productive in society.
Well, see, I think that's the thing, though, if we look at the, let's say, the American model, because socialized medicine kind of changes it up a bit. Every single thing regarding a hospital, whether it's the syringe or the bed or whatever, is commodified, right? It all has a value. Mm-hmm. It has a value up here, too, but that value is covered for the most part. There are other fees. And that's the thing. I mean, and, you know, Goldman Sachs, of all people, I mean, do me a favor and Google Goldman Sachs 2008. You'll find out a lot about Goldman Sachs and how they roll. I mean, they're pretty much, I wouldn't say single-handedly responsible for the mortgage crisis in the U.S., but they were big players in it.
Yeah.
And they paid a fine regarding it, I think, to the tune of $5 billion. They didn't have to admit culpability, I don't think. But if you're shelling out that much cash, which is probably chump change for them, like, these aren't anybody's friends, right? they're the friends of capital, right? They're not your friend if you are ill, right? So, and this is the problem. Do we, should healthcare be more under the auspices of public health, and as it is up here to a degree? But you know, these treatments, if they come out of the U.S. or wherever they come out of, then we will in turn have to pay into them somehow. But it's like, you know, to say that, is it a sustainable business model? The answer probably is no. But of course, there's a bit of a, you have to couch that in like, well, you know, you really should at least try. Will somebody try and cure the people without it being all about the bucks?
Oh no, they found us. I don't know how, but they
found us. Oh, there's a flashing light we need to address. So.
But somebody's on the phone. Yeah, it's, but the thing that struck me about this, though, is just the ickiness of the conversation, that someone had the thought to write the memo, which, of course, plays into just every kind of worst thought people have ever had about places like Goldman Sachs, many former executives of whom are now in the White House, by the way.
It's a Trump team, yeah, that's right.
And also of a big pharma in general, because, you know, Jonas Salk was probably the last person to ever cure anything. You know, we have different medicines for, you know, dealing with cosmetic things like erectile dysfunction, but we don't have medicines that, you know, help eliminate cancer or shrink tumors or.
And Viagra was an accidental discovery too, wasn't it? It's one of those things like, whoops.
But, you know, now there's like 57 variations of it. And you know, enough of it is such a moneymaker that, you know, the U.S. military itself spends millions of dollars on prescriptions for it every year. But, you know, where's the ALS treatment? Where's, you know, Parkinson's treatment? Even, you know, HIV treatment hasn't changed much in the last several years. It's
yeah, because there was that flurry of it. It's, you know, the cocktail. Yeah. And then you're right, it hasn't really evolved too much. And maybe that's the kind of thing that could be addressed by gene therapy in the future, too. Not being a medical specialist at all, but it's an evolving arm of medicine, let's say.
Well, yeah, what gene therapy does, and I'm not a scientist, so don't quote me on it, but from what I gather, you find genes and chromosomes or whatever that aren't doing their function, which is typically where you get diseases like cancer, where it takes genes and cells and turns them against the body, and then you plug in with like new artificial cells or some sort of gene therapy treatment that they come up with. But yeah, it's a brave new world, and Goldman Sachs doesn't want to be a part of it because they can't make money or as much money. So,
from Adam Suzuki and Neil deGrasse Hertz, good night and good luck.
That's good. Yeah, well, that's a good segue because it's a very busy political weekend here in town. We've got the Green Rally on Earth Day, which is Saturday. We're going to have Mike Schreiner, Elizabeth May, David Suzuki, and Sarah Harmer all at the Hanlon Convention Center. And then we have the selection of the NDP candidate at Evergreen Seniors also on Saturday afternoon. Andrea Horvath's going to be there. And we're going to try and cover all of it because we're just crazy like that. Anyway.
That's our job. You had two jobs.
We had two jobs. You can stay connected to us at opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter, and you can find us on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play to listen to this and past episodes. You can find me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scott Hertz on Facebook, Scott Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com.
Nailed it that time.
Yes. Somehow.
DJ Sounds Good to Me is here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we'll be back here next week with more open sources, and we'll see you then.